Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books and Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. In today's podcast, I speak with American professor Ira Heldermann about his newly published book, Prescribing the Dharma, Psychotherapist, Buddhist Traditions, and Defining Religion, which surveys the diversity of Buddhist practices used in psychotherapy today. Ira shows that psychotherapist approaches to Buddhist traditions are molded by how they relate to what is and is not religion. This book will be of interest to scholars of psychotherapy, religion, and Buddhism, as well as anyone interested in the relationship between psychotherapy and Buddhism in the West today. Ira, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Very happy to have you on the show. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you first became interested in psychotherapy and Buddhism.
So my background is something of a story. I do tell the story at the start of the book of the moment I became truly interested in this topic from a religious studies perspective, and the moment that ultimately took me to writing the book. But my curiosity probably began some years before that. So my story may be somewhat unusual in that I was a practicing clinician for many years before I became interested in religious studies and Buddhist studies research. So I had been doing individual therapy as a clinician in a university counseling center had been doing one-on-one counseling for almost half a decade, and had been working in the mental health field for some years before that. And if you had told me that when I was treating academics, if you had told me that I might actually become one myself, I wouldn't have laughed out loud at that idea, but I definitely would have been surprised. So as a clinician, as a therapist, I had been introduced over time to various practices and teachings that were introduced to me as Buddhist. And the first was a particular therapeutic modality called acceptance and commitment therapy, the developer of which ended up being an interviewee for my book, Stephen Hayes. And that's one of the mindfulness-based modalities that are so popular right now. But over time, I became curious, without fully naming it to myself, about what I was doing when I was introducing meditation in sessions with people, or when I would sit with somebody for whom cognitive behavioral therapy in a traditional way had not been useful. And I found myself thinking about the concept of the non-judging mind or non-attachment, I'm sorry, of the judging mind or non-attachment to thought. I think that even before I realized how curious I was about what I was doing at those times, that curiosity was growing. And then what I don't actually share in the book I actually don't think I disclose in the book that I meditate with people in sessions, but more than that, I also was starting to meditate, you know, outside of the office, and was working individually one-on-one with a teacher, going on retreats. So all of that kind of built up to the moment, like I say, that comes early in the book, where I've been going to continuing education conferences. All therapists have to maintain continuing education to maintain their license with the state. And so the continuing education conferences I had been going to for a few years were introducing how to, well, they build themselves differently each one, but many of them introduce them, you know, build themselves as how to incorporate integrate Buddhist and psychotherapeutic practices mm-hmm. and ideas. And one conference I went to, the main speaker was the Dalai Lama. And the whole conference was sort of patterned off of, to a certain extent, the mind-life dialogues. But this conference was sponsored by Harvard Medical School, and I've been going to they had one of these conferences kind of annually. I've been going to there for a few years, but this year it was set up as sort of a dialogue between prominent psychotherapists like Marsha Linehan, the founder of dialectical behavior therapy, and the Dalai Lama. And so I'm sitting there in this conference room with a few hundred other mental health clinicians. And we're listening to the Dalai Lama, a person that that thousands and thousands of Tibetans consider to be a deity, and the once theocratic leader of a nation state. And that's when it really hit me, the question, what is this exactly, as you have a room full of mental health clinicians, most of whom I think would define themselves as not religious, listening to a figure who so many consider to be, if not a deity, an emanation of a higher way of being, and a religious figure. And that curiosity, that question, ultimately took me back to change the, you know, I totally changed the course of my life, went into religious studies research, pursuing a whole other degree that is very, very relevant to my clinical work, because it's a PhD in religion, psychology, and culture, but it is a religious studies PhD, and ultimately that led to the book as well.
And what motivated you to write your new book, Prescribing the Dharma?
I think that in general, I was motivated by three different things. The first was I wanted to give voice to the psychotherapists, the actual human beings that are participating in activities that there's a lot of hot buzz and a fair amount of concern about, and even criticism that I felt didn't always give voice to the people that are actually participating. So that was one major motivation I had in writing the book. The second was, in kind of keeping with that, I wanted to sort of the diversity of ways that therapists approach Buddhist traditions, something else that I felt like was missing in the conversation. And then a deeper kind of motivation I had was wanting to kind of change the way that we talk about what it means for a therapist, for example, to take up a Buddhist practice, where so often we can speak about it as a process of secularization or religious transmission. I wanted to invite the conversation to more radically use those terms in a reflective way. So those are kind of the general points of motivation. But I could explain more about how that motivation came to me, if that would be helpful.
Sure, go for it.
So when I started conducting my research, I had come into it having done a fair amount of reading on the topic, but because there is a veritable cottage industry of books with titles like Buddhism and Psychotherapy. But they are by and large written by psychotherapists for other psychotherapists. But what I had found in my other life of as a therapist reading on this kind of material and reading from that perspective, I noticed that I was really most attracted to the one or two chapters in edited collections with, again, titles like Psychoanalysis and Buddhism that were written by religious studies and Buddhist studies scholars. So there were people working on this topic from a religious studies perspective, but they were pretty few. So when I started doing research and reading what was out there, I noticed that a lot of the conversation seemed to be dominated by the question of whether Buddhist teachings and practices, Buddhist traditions, were being secularized. Again, the idea that there was a secularization process taking place when psychotherapists got their hands on these material objects was usually couched in terms of anxiety or critique. And then there seemed to be other voices that were kind of responding to those critiques. And their perspective seemed to be, this is actually kind of part of natural processes of religious transmission. This is just the way that Buddhist traditions are being introduced to a new population here in the United States of non-Buddhists, a non-Buddhist majority culture. The earliest writings that I found on often kind of treated psychotherapists' interest in Buddhist traditions as kind of just another sort of face of Buddhism, as the title of one book that included a selection on the topic said. So when I was reading this material, the first thing that occurred to me was that it often flattened out the diversity of ways that therapists approached Buddhist tradition. So people that were looking at ubiquitous and all popular, powerful mindfulness movement, as many of them called it, and were listening to clinicians that were intentionally trying to take a practice or a concept they defined as religious and make it secular or science or some other term of the not religious, like scientific or medical. When a scholar would hyper-focus on those kind of activities, they were often leaving out those therapists out there that were deep believing Buddhists and might talk about the four noble truths with the people that came to see them for therapy, or other practitioners who were some of the most fervent critics of bringing Buddhist material into their practices at all. And if you listen to their sessions, you would never know that they also happen to be Buddhist teachers and leaders of Buddhist communities themselves. So those who were describing a secularization narrative often would leave out those communities, those kinds of therapists. And at the same time, people that were telling a narrative of religious transmission often didn't sort of fully account for therapists who were introducing Buddhist practices or teaching them to others, only knowing them as secularized items. And all of that occurred to me just from my background as a therapist, what I came to think of as kind of my ethnographic access. I just
you know, kind of knew those therapists out there and would be reading a piece and thinking, well, this doesn't really, this seems to not know the existence of someone like Barry Magid or other people that ended up becoming interviewees for me for my book. So that was the first thing. But the second was I was a new religious studies scholar and started to, you know, as my story of how I became interested in the topic points to, from the beginning, I was interested in these questions of the religious and not religious, because my kind of first starting point question was, okay, you know, these therapists that are mental health practitioners surrounding me, they define themselves as not religious, but they are working with elements that they define as religious. How does that work exactly? But you know, as a new religious studies scholar, I began to learn about the history of these concepts of the term, the word religion, the word secular, and how they're very relatively recent ideas, and that some people feel like aren't applicable to ancient times in, you know, what we now call Europe, and remained not applicable to the continent of Asia, and so that research really took me in a whole new direction, where I said to myself, "So what? You know, if these words, religion and secular, are have constantly shifting definitions and are socially constructed, what does it mean for us to say we are combining religious Buddhist practice with scientific or secular, some term of the not religious psychotherapeutic practice? If we take a step back and we're more reflective about our use of those terms, doesn't it completely and totally change our conversation?" And where that ultimately took me was the realization that the people that I was reading, the psychotherapists, you know, from Carl Jung and William James to the contemporary figures that I ultimately interviewed for the book, they themselves had their own sense of what was religious and what was not. They themselves were questioning what is the definition of religion, and debating amongst themselves about the proper definition for these terms. And their approaches to Buddhist traditions were fundamentally shaped by how they defined what is and is not religious, and how they define themselves within those terms. And I think I'll stop there, because I'll probably say more about all of that shortly.
Okay. And one of the key insights of the book that you just referred to is that Buddhism-based practices are shaped by how psychotherapists view the boundary between religion and science, or the secular and the non-secular. And this gives shapes to how these have been adopted into practice. Where are the various spots that psychotherapists put this border?
So it varies from therapist to therapist, from therapeutic community to therapeutic community, and really from session to session sometimes with an individual therapy. You know, I think of my book as it includes a lot of history, and I do I did ethnographic observation and interviews for the book, but I think of it as much as a typology, as much as an ethnography and a history. And so the structure of the book is kind of maps out the different approaches that therapists have taken to Buddhist traditions, as shaped by where they place the borderlines between the religious and not religious. And so you have some therapists who believe that it's important for psychotherapy to maintain its definition as not religious, whether they're using the term medical, scientific, secular, or a more generic, just not religious. And of course, what they mean by those terms and not religious varies from therapist to therapist, community to community. And so you, some people that feel very strongly about maintaining psychotherapy is not religious, non-religiosity. But then you have other therapists from the very beginning, from when talk therapy, as we know it, was invented, by Freud. You had his student Carl Jung questioning psychotherapy's definition within these categories of the religious and not religious. Again, where different therapeutics communities draw the borderline ends up kind of shaping how they approach Buddhist teachings and practices. So cognitive behavioral therapists, for example, are really many of them. Those communities are highly invested in maintaining their status as scientific biomedical practitioners. It's really important to them that they be seen as only using quote unquote empirically validated treatment modalities. And so, but many of them did believe that Buddhist teachings and practices would be helpful, could help their people coming to see them for therapy to resist cravings, to cut on themselves, for example, to self-harm. So they felt like this put a dilemma to them, and their solution was to try to use what they saw as secular and not religious in these Buddhist teachings and practices, and remove what was religious within them. But then you have other practitioners who believe that it's only going to be really useful to folks if you contextualize those teachings and practices within the larger Buddhist frameworks that they know. And so it's important to them to say to the people coming to them for therapy, this comes from Buddhism. As one of my interviewees, Joe Luizzo, says, that he often will tell people, this comes from Buddhism. There's a wealth of resources beyond this practice I'm introducing to you that you can learn about. And so each of the chapters of my book maps out a different approach, whether it be what I call translating religion. That's what I was just referring to, where cognitive behavioral therapists believe that they are taking a religious item and making it into not religious, or what I call adopting religion approaches, where a therapist will view their therapy as fully Buddhist in nature, and we'll refer to it as Buddhist therapy or Zen psychoanalysis.
Mm. And as you referred to previously, there are many attitudes about the adoption of Buddhism-based practices within psychotherapy from many different parties and actors involved, from professional authorities to patients to Buddhists themselves. What do the professional authorities and oversight organizations feel about the incorporation of religious elements into psychotherapeutic use?
Yes, because it's a really important question, because your last question was sort of asking where therapists draw the borderline or boundary lines between the religious and not religious. But those the places that they draw the borderlines are shaped by multiple other factors. Not just the authorities within their own communities, the authoritative figures and authoritative bodies within their own communities, whether that be a particular therapeutic orientation, like psychoanalysts and the social norms that are created. If you say you're a psychoanalyst, around personal disclosure, for example, so you wouldn't bring in your religious identity into a therapy session. But not just those social norms created by those communities, but multiple other factors. So, the most famous and popular mindfulness practices. I'm noticing myself bringing it up frequently, but as much as that, even though it is only the tip of the iceberg of the diversity that exists, but it is an easy cultural touchstone to point to. And, you know, the borderline between the religious and not religious for the developers of mindfulness-based practices was drawn by hospital authorities in many cases, and they were definitely concerned about managed healthcare and insurance companies, and where a utilization review board would what they would consider to be acceptable to be within psychotherapy. But those aren't the only authorities that are contributing to this conversation. Because so many of the therapists that are interested in Buddhist tradition, so many of the therapists that I spoke to and whose work I read, again, consider themselves deep believers in Buddhist practice, and so they're also looking to Buddhist authorities about what is acceptable and unacceptable, what is ethical and unethical. And so you have practitioners that will be reading critiques from Buddhist studies scholars and Buddhist practitioners who expressing concern about cultural appropriation and the capitalization of Buddhist practices. So what I describe and what I try to put together in the conclusion of the book is the way that, you know, an individual therapist or therapeutic community is kind of weaving in between these different authorities and authoritative bodies, and will kind of shift where they place the line depending on what authorities they may be in contact with. So you'll have a therapist who, before one audience, will emphasize that a particular Buddhist concept is, taken out of context, just a cognitive restructuring technique or a different way of looking at something. But then, in front of another audience, will contextualize that practice within a wider path. The most important kind of determinant there that I have not brought up yet, that I think is really, really important, is that one of the main terms beyond in terms of the religious and not religious that therapists have struggled with over time is the term health itself or well-being itself. So from the beginning, you had therapists, again, from the beginning of the invention of talk therapy, you had therapists that looked at the ultimate aim of therapy as being to restore someone to health or to, quote unquote, wholeness. Mm-hmm. You had therapists that looked at the practice as trying to heal somebody from sickness to illness. But you had others who thought, like Jung, who thought the idea was to bring someone to a point of self-actualization and to reach a kind of higher state of being. And so, that's, to me, as much as anything, that's sort of what determines what a therapist is going to do is what's the aim here? Am I trying to help somebody to just reduce their anxiety symptoms, or am I trying to bring them to something much larger? And the authorities and authoritative bodies that they come in contact are operating from their own perspective on those issues, whether they're fully conscious of that. Mm-hmm. Or not. And so, and maybe just one last point on this question in that regard is that, I feel like that oftentimes these conversations can, end up sort of totalizing what's happening into narratives of secularization or capitalization. It can be easy to look at everything that's happening with psychotherapists' interest in Buddhist traditions and say portray these folks as all kind of cogs in the wheel of global capitalism, or just as empty vessels for the spread of the Dharma. But what I think is so important is to remember that we're talking about actual human beings, and that includes the president of a hospital, the CEO of a managed healthcare company, who, you know, may be maintaining a certain borderline between the religious and not religious during a board meeting, but then will leave the office and go to see a therapist who introduces to them Buddhist practices. And so for those people, for those actual human beings as well, the lines shift from day to day, moment to moment. And I think it's really important to maintain that sense of nuance and complexity.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And let's talk about the patient's perspective on this. I know that some patients are open to therapies that originate in Buddhism, but I'm sure there are patients who wouldn't feel so comfortable with this or wouldn't feel comfortable having any religion-derived therapies at all in their mental health treatment plans. So what are the reactions that you typically hear from patients to Buddhism-based treatments?
So yes, I feel like many therapists are very concerned about sort of the reaction of how the people that come to see them for therapy will react, and that many of their approaches are shaped by those concerns. So, a person that's seeking out therapy, thinking that what they're seeking is a medical modality, a medical form of healing, therapists will be concerned that if they were to introduce a practice that they identify as Buddhist or religious, could create anxiety for that person or lead them to reject it altogether. So I think what can often be forgotten is that there are many people that are seeking therapy in present day, and for some years now, that does have a Buddhist approach to it. And so there are two different ways that this can go. Then you have therapists who will say that part of why they have attempted to take a Buddhist concept or practice and make it into and translate it into a not religious item is precisely so that it can be accessible to therapists that could really be helped by it, but would otherwise reject it or feel like it was dissonant with their own religious background. But you also have therapists that are responding to a need, or at least a perceived need on the part of people out there that are seeking help, but that want, but believe that they're going to be most helped by Buddhist philosophy and a Buddhist path. One of the more interesting kind of phenomena that came up around this for me was discovering therapists who the term I gave for the kinds of approaches they take is personalizing religion approaches. And I see figures like Eric Fromm and another really important psychodynamic therapist named Karen Hornight, initially coming up with, which is that therapists can believe that they are deeply, deeply engaged with Buddhist practice and have had deeply transformative Buddhist experiences, but they hold that all within their person, within the person of the therapist, is a phrase that many therapists use, and won't ever actually bring it up in sessions. And so when I began interviewing people, my interviewees were all published therapists. And so, I picked up a book by a therapist who I saw as very much following in this category of fully adopting a Buddhist perspective in their therapist based on their writings. But when I reached out to them, I found that they never talked about it at all in sessions. I think that at least part of that would be part of the motivation for therapists taking that approach would be concern about how the people coming to see them might react to the introduction of Buddhist practices. So this is often a large source of discussion. What I come to, again, the conclusion of my book is that I feel like it's really important. Most of the book is directed towards religious studies scholars, but at the very end, I do address therapists as well to say that I think it's important for therapists and scholars to kind of be aware of their own values and principles and what shapes them in their approaches. Is it more important for if a therapist believes that a practice can really help somebody come out of suicidal thinking, knowing that suicide kills people every day, is it more important for them to use that or to regardless of how it's introduced, or will they actually be doing harm to that person in a certain sense incorporating a religious practice into a system of cultural appropriation and colonialist history that ultimately does more harm to society than good. Hopefully that's not too convoluted and made some sense there.
No, I think it really points to the fact that some very sticky ethical issues can arise by incorporating these types of practices into therapeutic modalities.
Yeah, and I guess my message there is just that I feel like oftentimes these discussions become ethical without us naming that they are ethical, so that oftentimes people, but just like the normative positions vary widely. So when somebody says that something has been secularized in one community from one position, that is a critique, and for another, it's a reassurance, where secular equals bad or good, to put it quite plainly. But that I feel like everybody is taking in these conversations is taking an ethical position, whether they know it or not, and that we should be clear-eyed and honest about what position is being taken if when we make a determination, like when a therapist makes a determination about whether to introduce a practice or not into a session, or a cultural critic accuses that person of doing harm. All members of that conversation should be curious, should be clear about what is my value, what is my normative position here, and where does that come from?
So I want to step back for a moment and talk about actually the different types of practices that are in use. I think nowadays, when people think of types of Buddhism-based practices and psychotherapy, they immediately think of meditation and mindfulness. And certainly, without a doubt, that's definitely very widespread. But are these the only Buddhism-based therapies being used today, or are there other modalities out there?
There certainly are. And then there are approaches that therapists have taken that lead to not using Buddhist traditions in psychotherapy. And I try to map all of that out in the book. And I really appreciate the question because it is just so easy to talk about mindfulness practices and meditation practices as the whole story here. The phrase I use in the book is that they can tend to swallow up the conversation like a black hole. But a way to communicate the diversity here is that, you know, I've written this book. It's not a short book. It's not ridiculously long. Don't be too scared if you're listening. But it's not a short book. And you know, there are six or seven chapters in them, and only one of them is on mindfulness practice. So the rest of the book is on the considerable and perhaps surprisingly diverse ways that therapists have approached Buddhist traditions. And so and that, like I say, includes therapists who approach Buddhist doctrine or Buddhist thought and will, what I call, therapize that thought without ever using it in therapy necessarily. So some of the earliest psychotherapists to take up Buddhist teachings fall into this category where they would read a quote-unquote Buddhist text, and asterisks there that I'll come back to, and analyze the Buddhist practitioner described in that text to uncover the true psychodynamic causes that would lead someone to seek a meditative oceanic experience and reveal it to be, for instance, a narcissistic yearning to return to a union with the mother. It was one of the early interpretations of Buddhist states. And so that practitioner, that therapist was definitely not interested in incorporating or practicing a Buddhist therapy. And as a side note, those therapists, there are therapists out there that continue to take that approach of kind of using psychotherapeutic ideas about illness and health to interpret Buddhist teachings and practices, but some of them are incorporating them into their therapy today. So today you have therapists who, far from are only practicing mindfulness modalities, but you have therapists who believe that they are practicing a Zen psychoanalysis, where they see their therapy as fully shaped by Zen teachings and Zen practices, by their understanding of what a path towards true health, if they even use that word, to enlightenment would be. And so you'll even have practitioners introducing deity visualization practices with those who come to see them. So it could be a fair amount of diversity there, as is the world of psychotherapy itself, where you do have behavioral therapists, you have psychoanalytic therapists and their schools, you have feminist relational cultural therapists, and that diversity it shapes again the way that each of those communities will approach what Buddhist teachings and how they define what is and is not authentically Buddhist. And that's the last note I want to make on this question that I feel regretful I haven't been reemphasizing with every question, which is, just as definitions of what is religious and not are wholly important in this discussion, so is definitions of what is Buddhist or not. Because even Joe Luizzo, as a name I mentioned earlier, he has a consortium of therapists called the Nalanda Institute, and his story is kind of interesting because he had been a practicing psychiatrist for some years, and then returned to work with Robert Thurman at Columbia University. He got a PhD in Buddhist studies, translating Buddhist texts With the desire to be presenting a Buddhist therapy that he saw as truly serious and, to use his word, rigorous. And so Joe Luizzo does introduce and does talk about deity visualization techniques, and he does talk about certain aspects of Buddhist philosophy that are not talked about much in the communities that therapists are involved in, like karma. But even he still is looking at deity visualization as a role-playing technique, and still, for the most part, looks at is not treating deities the way most Buddhists on the planet do still today. Well, that may be stating it too strongly, but certainly throughout most history. And so I think it's really important that to underline that the Buddhist communities in which therapists were introduced to what was called Buddhist are by and large what are often called convert Buddhist communities populated by people of European descent. And so concerns about what is authentically Buddhist or not, to a large degree, are about issues of philosophy that don't take into consideration some of the most central aspects of Buddhist teachings and practices that one finds, say, in Thailand. They're definitely not concerned with merit-making practices or paradise lands. When they talk about trying to achieve or live into becoming a bodhisattva, they're talking about a certain way of being and an ethical approach or philosophical approach, but they're not talking about achieving bodhisattva supermundane powers like teleportation, in the way that for most of history this is Buddhist communities were concerned about or at least placing into their cosmographies. There's a lot more to be said about that point, but I'll pause there.
And what is the history of Buddhist practices being used in psychotherapy? From many people's perspective who are just now starting to hear the words mindfulness, meditation, and advertisements, and being spoken about by their therapists and so forth, it might seem like a new phenomenon. But is this a new phenomenon? Is there an older, longer history between Buddhist practices and psychotherapy?
Yeah, I appreciate that question as well, because it is something that is one of the main messages I do try to communicate, is that I feel like that the psychotherapist's interest in Buddhist traditions can often be kind of described as a new popular fad, and it's been described as a new popular fad for some decades now. and I think that part of that is a way of kind of dismissing it as superficial and frivolous, but it does have a history that goes back over a century, or at least psychotherapist's interest in Buddhist traditions goes back over a century to very soon after the invention of, again, talk therapy as we know it. And I do try to, although the book is laid out as a mapping kind of typology of these different approaches, I do try to piece together that history, including aspects of that history that is often not told. So the story of how early psychologists, at the birth of that academic discipline of the new psychology, and the role that the role that Buddhist traditions played in psychologists of religion's thought, the first psychologists of religion, is often not told. People will often kind of tell this perhaps apocryphal story of how William James offered his seat at the or his place at the lectern to Dharmasala as sort of a representation of how psychologists and psychotherapists have for a long time now looked to raised Buddhist thought up as as important and worth placing alongside European psychological thought or new psychological thought. But the word Buddhism surfaces in really interesting ways throughout the early psychologists of religion thinking about their about what religion was and what religion was becoming. So yes, there is a real history here, and I feel like knowing that history is important. Another episode that I think of often when around conversations around mindfulness practices is even more in recent history, the 40s and 50s, and a figure like Eric Fromm, who, back in the 50s was anticipating some of the same and presenting some of the same critiques that we hear today about capitalization and the way in which religious practices can be perverted to do harm in a larger societal way. I'm going to hold back from getting too deep into that, but hopefully that's enough to get somebody interested to read more.
And so my second question is actually just the reverse, is can we see that psychotherapists have had an influence on Western Buddhism or the adoption of Western or Buddhism in the West?
Absolutely. That's something else that I think that surfaces throughout the book, even though that is less my point of emphasis. And so I'll plug another scholar and friend's book. Anne Gleig has a book out right around now as well, and who really attends to the way in which psychotherapy has been approached by Buddhist communities, sort of the reverse there. But you can find that history chapter by chapter surface in my book to a certain extent as well. You know, what I often think about is that, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about how that we should be really clear about what Buddhist traditions we're talking about that are being incorporated into psychotherapy when we say that they are, because again, it's rare that a merit making practice or propitiation of a divinity is being incorporated. The Buddhist communities that therapists are drawing from are communities that they themselves are shaping. So you have a figure like Jack Kornfield, who is, one of the leading kind of Buddhist figures in the U.S., has, founded Buddhist communities that have in turn influenced other Buddhist communities. And, his dual identity as a psychologist, as well as a Buddhist teacher, is hugely important. You have therapists who are you have Buddhist communities that now use as their core texts in teachings books that are written by no less a translator of religion as Jon Kabat-Zinn will be cited in Dharma talks at a local Zendo. And so there's definitely a feedback loop that's taking place between what's happening in the world of psychotherapy and in within Buddhist groups. And again, this goes back very far to a figure like Carl Jung, for whom, who D.T. Suzuki reached out to write the introduction of his book, so that every practitioner in the U.S. who picked up D.T. Suzuki's introduction to Zen was being introduced by it literally in an introduction in the foreword by Carl Jung.
So it seems like there's been a very long history in the West between psychotherapy and Buddhism, that they've had, like you said, a feedback loop that has kind of given shape to both sides of the equation and what we have today. What is the future of Buddhism-based treatments in psychotherapy? Is it here to stay, or what developments do you think we'll see in the future?
So that's a great question. I think that to a large degree, my sense is that the ethical questions is dominating a lot of the sort of the conversations and has for some years now amongst therapists that are interested in Buddhist traditions. And this is something that when I first started writing and presenting some of my research, I had just not heard before, but now it is definitely part. I've heard other scholars point out as well, and that is that some of the same concerns about cultural appropriation or neoliberalism that I was reading cultural critics and religious studies scholars and Buddhist studies scholars express are being discussed amongst psychotherapists themselves, and therapists themselves are sort of talking about what's the ethical way of approaching Buddhist traditions that doesn't fall into some of those traps. And you know, part of that's because they're reading those Buddhist studies and religious studies scholars and are influenced by those critiques and are wanting to maintain, wanting to be seen as practicing an authentic Buddhist practice and are wanting to avoid unethical approaches. I think about one of the continuing education conferences that I ended up observing from my ethnographic observation, where the general tenor of the conversation was these kind of concerns and the misuse of Buddhist practices for in corporate settings, which people were concerned about that it could just lead to what you know Eric Fromm called sort of adjustment to an oppressive capitalistic system, essentially. And so how can we is that a problem? And how can we address that as a problem? The therapists were kind of asking, and you know one solution was that what had been decontextualized from Buddhist traditions should be recontextualized back on kind of the Eightfold Path, for example. And so that's one thing I think about. The other thing I think about is I'm curious to see what, because again, we can't underline enough that how much is shaped by both, I would say, not just therapists, but also scholars' understanding of what is health or well-being or societal good. When early therapists were approaching Buddhist traditions, their sense of what the ultimate aim of a authentic psychotherapy or authentic Buddhist path was very different from what it was from even between decade to decade. So where Eric Fromm was dialoguing with D.T. Suzuki around the becoming more autonomous beings freed from totalitarian structures, a kind of individualist, one might say, kind of perspective, a few decades later, you have therapists who are more interested in interconnection, and that the ultimate in a Buddhist and psychotherapeutic path would be people becoming more interconnected and interrelated. I always find that really interesting because, as a scholar as David McMahon has talked about and has it as a chapter in his book Making of Buddhist Modernism, talks about interconnection for most of Buddhist history was a trap, was something to be escaped rather than something to be deeply to be more embedded into. Nonetheless, I'm wondering what will be the next ultimate aim that that therapists and Buddhist communities alike in their dialogues with each other see themselves heading to? What will be the next kind of definition of of enlightenment, health, well-being, and terms of the like that therapists will feel is their responsibility to bring hurting or even suffering people towards. Mm.
I guess we'll see in the future soon enough. Well, I'd like to congratulate you again on your recently published book, Prescribing the Dharma, Psychotherapist, Buddhist Traditions, and Defining Religion. I imagine that you'll be enjoying a well-deserved rest now that the book is on the shelves.
Thank you so much. This has been really enjoyable. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Happy to have you on. And what's for you next? Do you have any plans for future research projects?
So I do. What I'm working on now kind of comes from the last part of the title of the book that you just read. In the first chapter, full chapter of Prescribing the Dharma, it's sort of a glossary of sorts where I try to give, drawing from my interviews and my literature review, try to give an introduction to therapists' definitions for terms of the religious and not religious, and then try to give some of the genealogical background for, you know, why it is that therapists would believe that religion is defined by internal belief, and how that dates back to, for example, or deities, and how that dates back to the invention of the modern concept of religion, for example. So all that to say that one of the terms in that chapter is spirituality, a central term that comes up throughout the book. And my next project is looking at that term in particular and the history of that word and the way that psychotherapists and psychotherapeutic stuff has influenced contemporary dominant understandings of what that word means. You know, most psychotherapists, many of whom I talk about in this book, when they use the word spiritual, it was in a very different sense than the way many psychotherapists use it today. Often, you know, as a synonym for religion, spiritual or religious, where many today are using it spiritual, not religious. And believe it or not, not just in terms of my interest in these concepts and categories, it's connected to Prescribing the Dharma and that research project in that sense, but it's connected in another sense as well, which is that a major part of that research is going to be looking at the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, which is the book that therapists use to diagnose people. And I'm going to be looking at the way the term spiritual shows up and religion shows up in that book, which very interestingly is often used as a sort of like a representation of the medicalization of experience. But if you just Google DSM and look at any popular article on the book, it will always be called the Bible of Psychotherapists or Psychiatrists Bible at the same time. In any case, there is a diagnostic code in there that is spiritual problem. And the existence of that diagnostic code or area of clinical interest dates directly back to meditation retreats, actually. I'm excited to tell that story of how one led to the other.
Well, I'm definitely looking to, of course, we'll have you on the show when that's available. But for the moment, I want to thank you again for coming on the show to speak about your new book, Prescribing the Dharma. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies with Alex Carroll. If you're interested in learning about other new books in Buddhist Studies, head over to newbooksnetwork.com or search for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts. Audio used with permission from Musique Délicieuse and is taken from the song Small Flower by Para Furkova.